TCS Legends is powered by Mitel. For all your unified communications and customer experience needs, visit mitel.com. I'm Duncan MacLeod. Welcome to TCS Legends, the podcast series from Tech Central that, as the name implies, talks to some of the legends who helped shape South Africa's tech sector to become what it is today. And we have one of those legends with us in the studio today. Before I introduce him, just a reminder, you can subscribe to us at youtube.com/TechCentral and you'll never miss an episode of the show. And if you missed our opening double act with Duarte da Silva or our interview about Mustek founder David Kahn, do go back and have a watch or listen to those shows. They're well worth it. And do get subscribed on any of the platforms where you get your favorite podcasts. We've got a great lineup of interviews coming over the coming months, so do subscribe and stay in touch with TCS Legends. Now, I'm really looking forward to my next conversation today, and we really do have a legend of the internet industry in South Africa in the studio, none other than Mike Laurie, who was instrumental in helping bring the first internet connection to South Africa at Rhodes University back in the, was it the late 80s or the early 90s, Mike?
Early 90s,
right. Okay. Well, welcome to the show. It's really good to see you. It's been a long time since I last saw you. I think the last time I saw you was about 25 years ago.
Probably.
Yeah.
Aged a bit.
Late 90s, yeah, we all have in that time. And the tech world, of course, has moved on significantly in that
time.
Yeah. But we're going to be going back even further than that and looking to quite an exciting period in South Africa's computing industry history. And that was the really exciting work that happened at Rhodes University in the late 80s. And the first internet connection that was brought to South Africa, when was it, 1991?
Yeah, November 91. I forget the exact day. I think it was the 11th or the 12th or something like that.
How does one define an internet connection? Was it an internet protocol packet that traversed a network internationally?
Well, the way we defined it certainly was that it had to be on a leased line.
Okay.
And the testing was done with a ping. It's one of the protocols of the internet. That once the pings worked, it was quite clear everything else was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then the traffic would just take off.
You know? Yeah.
So I guess a ping is the thing. And that actual ping, the guy at the far end, a chap called Randy Bush, which we'll talk about him.
Sure, we will, definitely.
He actually recorded it. And that's the sort of thing he does, that sort of person.
Yeah.
And I think it's available somewhere on the net. You actually see the response times for that leased circuit, leased line went in. And I don't know, that's when it was. And that was the big anti-climax, actually, because from then on, it should have been very easy.
Yeah. But it must have been a thrilling moment. I mean, what went through your mind when it happened?
You know, it's difficult to describe. It really, really is. In the one sense, it was an anticlimax because we got there.
Mm.
And excitement, yes, it was. You know, the tenseness is going to work. Is it really now that it's happening? But there was, the build-up must have started in about mid-88.
Okay.
When we went really serious after international email.
Right.
Lots of failures en route.
Okay.
Not going to talk about that.
Sure.
But there were lots.
Well, let's get into it.
It's another thing.
Let's go even further back, Mike. Let's talk about your career and what led up to this particular moment. So you joined Rhodes in
71.
In 71. But you'd actually done some work with them even earlier than that in the 1960s.
Yeah, I was a student. I was extremely fortunate. The company I was with sold, hired, rented, whatever the term is, a computer to Rhodes University, a mainframe computer, a thing called the ICT-1301.
Who made that?
ICT.
Okay.
In England.
Mm-hmm. Competitor to IBM, was it?
A competitor to IBM, very much so. It's difficult to describe.
Massive.
So, physically massive, computer-wise, peanuts, absolutely peanuts. You know, you can't compare to a cell phone.
Right.
Okay, so I won't even attempt to do that because the scale is enormous.
Yeah.
But it was such in a fun environment at Rhodes University. I was there to look after the machine to keep it running.
Okay.
And the Rhodes very kindly said, well, you know, if you're bored, you can attend some lectures if you're academically qualified. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a matric pass.
Okay.
My strength always was in maths, applied maths. By then I'd had a national engineering diploma from the Cape Technicon. Mm-hmm. I had electrical background, electronic background, degree of academic background, and I was there for 4 years in that role. Ended up with an honours degree in maths and applied maths. Well, the honours degree is technically in mathematics. The subjects were in statistics and applied maths.
Were there any computer science degrees at that time?
Computer science was only just starting up as a topic in the last year I was there, 1969, mm-hmm. that department got established. I wasn't part of it. Computer science seems to be a funny thing. You punch holes in cards, you feed through the card reader, and that's what computing's about. Where's the science? I don't see it. Mm-hmm. But obviously there's lots in computer science. There's a great deal to it.
Yes, sure.
But at the time, it seemed to be a very funny subject to have, or to me anyway.
So you looked after this machine. It was an ICT-made computer. It probably filled a room. Weighed a ton.
Yeah.
Was it made of vacuum tubes?
Weighed a ton. No. It was a modern one.
Okay.
It had transistors.
Oh, right.
Discrete transistors, not integrated circuits. This was advanced in its day. They were, in fact, mainly germanium transistors as opposed to silicon transistors. Mm-hmm. Silicon transistors were the cutting edge because they were heat insensitive. The germanium ones, when they got overly hot, they did funny things. But the room that was in, it didn't require air conditioning. It could handle 40 degrees centigrade and did on quite a few occasions. And that's when the faults tended to pop up, and it was my job to nail them. So you'd find the dud transistor down to the transistor level. I would have to do that, and you bring out the soldering iron and you unsolder the component, put another one in there from the spares box.
So it was quite an electrical job, actually.
It was an electronic job. It was a job of logic. Mm-hmm. You know, the computer prior to that from the same company, if I can be a bit technical.
Please.
It had things called clock pulses. Clock pulses were the timing pulses. Things happen clock, 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 and that's when the flip-flops flipped and the flop-flops flopped. And the gates opened and the gates closed in sync with the clock pulses.
Wow.
Now, those clock pulses were 40 milliseconds long. Now, human reaction time is about a good, fast human will react in 20 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. So this was twice as fast as a human reaction, which is incredibly slow. This computer, its clock pulses were running at a microsecond.
Wow.
So that's 40,000 times faster. And the engineers of the day said, it will not be possible to maintain such a computer. You will not be able to keep track of what's going on. But I was too young to know that. Of course, I went on, was in, 62, worked on those computers for a year or two in Cape Town. Then I was off at Rhodes.
Right.
And you had to visualize what was happening in the computers. You had to have utter logical thinking. It was no good bringing emotions in that you thought it might be here or you thought it might be there, because you would fool yourself. The precise logic nature of the job of fixing those machines, I took to it like a duck to water.
Okay.
I loved it. Utter logic. 101 equals 2. Well, it equals naught, actually, in a computer terminology. You know, to imagine which gate must have failed, to imagine how it could have happened, to imagine, and then to home in on actually showing that it wasn't that, so try something else.
So what was this computer being used for?
It was initially came for the physicists.
Okay.
Professor Jack Gledhill was very much into ionospheric research. I think he did a lot of work on the hole in the ionosphere down in Antarctica, but I don't know. I wasn't sure. Into physics in a big way.
Okay.
I stopped at second year. It was too easy. Well, not quite, but maths was more interesting.
Sure.
The main purpose was a chap, ended up being Professor Terry, doing his master's degree, theoretically tracing rays through the ionosphere, rays of energy, I suppose. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of that done. We threw in a sideline, did some computer dating on that for one arts and science ball at Rhodes University. It upset a few people. I think the Senate thought that an expensive computer shouldn't be used for something as frivolous as that. But it certainly brought the computer home to every student on the campus. Everyone filled in a description of themselves. There were 5 points or 10 points or something like that of themselves and of their ideal partner for the arts and science ball.
That's how Zuckerberg got his start at Facebook. There was a way of rating the female students on campus. That was the genesis of Facebook as well. So it seems to be a thing
that
male geeks do at university.
Oh, we do. We thought it'd be a fun thing, and it really was a fun thing. Mm. What is it used for? There was there were odds and ends, but the main thing was physics. It was not used, and this is one of the big differences that Rhodes had compared to all other universities. And I think this is very, very much a foundation of what we did later. Mm-hmm. It was there to be used. It was open. It was not there for the administration. Mm-hmm. They weren't prohibited, but there was no interest from the administration. 1,500 students at the university. A lady called Miss Elliot, I think, knew everyone by name and face. Why do they need a computer to track the students?
There was
no need, but it was an academic machine. It went there for academic purposes and nothing else. Mm-hmm.
How long did it actually take for the physicists, for example, to run queries on this machine? Was it incredibly
slow? Pat ran forever. I mean, he would have one run of a program with certain starting parameters or whatever he put into his program. I really do not know. Such that at one stage, when he was getting near the end of his time as a master's student, and he had a bursary to go to Cambridge, he actually slept under the computer, under the console with a loud alarm loudspeaker on, so when the program stopped, it would go beep and he could restart with other set of parameters in order to get the stuff through. It was basically an open door. If you had the go-ahead, and there's no formal go-ahead process, the students didn't actually do anything on the computer, but researchers did odd bits of work on it. I don't think there were analyses of large surveys. I don't think there was anything of that nature. Mm-hmm. I don't recall that.
Okay.
It was far more the science guys doing silly things.
Okay. So you completed your degree then at Rhodes, and you moved on. You went back to Cape Town, I think.
It was first to Joburg for a few months.
Okay.
And the company wanted me down in Cape Town, and I went down there. And basically 18 months after I got my honours degree at Rhodes, I took up the post of computer manager at Rhodes University.
Okay.
They were looking for someone to run. There was no staff running that computer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the computer was there.
After you left, it was just there.
Well, no, but even when I was there, I wasn't there to run, to show staff and academics how to use the computer. Mm-hmm. I was there to fix it.
Okay.
And I mean, I would help. You've got to show people how to use punch holes in a card and that sort of thing. Put them through but I didn't live there at the computer. Mm-hmm. You know, I was busy studying.
So you'd pop in from time to time and make sure things were running smoothly.
There'd be a daily routine through there. I'd run a few tests each day and that sort of thing. And that would be the place where I'd lounge around when there was nothing on the go.
So what year did you return to Rhodes?
In 71, mid-71.
71, okay. Yeah. And just take us briefly through the progression of computers and how they advanced through the 1970s and 80s.
Well, I was now the first full-time employee of the university in a computer managing role. Mm-hmm. Computer manager was the title. Computer science was pretty well established by then. Okay. It was doing very well. It was very popular. Punch cards were still was the only way to get your stuff through the computer. There was not a very good operating system on that computer. It was an ICL 1901A.
Also a mainframe.
Mainframe. Mm-hmm. It needed air conditioning. It had integrated circuits. Ooh, it was really cutting edge.
Probably cost a fortune too.
I suppose. Cost, who cares what the cost is? Not my problem. Well, it was when I was computer manager. Yeah, one had to make sure the budgets and that sort of stuff. The students would punch their own cards. You know, they wouldn't hand in a code sheet and have someone else punch the cards, because there's no one there to punch the cards for them.
Mm-hmm.
They'd do it themselves. I mean, it was a way of learning computing that I think every student who went through it was extremely grateful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really learned computing. You realized what it was like to drop a deck of cards on the floor. And there's your program gone, so you don't do it. We had at one stage a computer operator, and they'd put the students or whoever was doing the computer was basically students at that stage, still no administration work. They'd punch job control language cards, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 cards, say, compile this program and print it and save the output somewhere. Mm-hmm. And operator used to feed it through, and that really wasn't successful. I said to students, you know, if you want to carry on at night, I mean, the Rhodes campus is very much an open campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a closed-door campus. I don't think there's too many locks. I'm not sure, actually. So those students who were keen enough and willing, and I think it was all the computer science students, certainly no one was barred.
Mm-hmm.
If you could show me that you could handle the computer, you had to tear the printout off, you knew how to type a command or two on the console, you knew how to punch your cards and feed them in, you wouldn't let the card reader jam. If it did, you wouldn't try to fix it, you'd call for help, and you wouldn't get sacked. You would be, you know, that's fine, that's the correct thing to do.
Yeah.
And the students loved it. It was, and come in after hours, well, that's fine. And it created an ethos of computing that, it's impossible to describe. It was fantastic. The pleasure of having young people doing that part of computing, not just writing code, but doing it all. And they would come in at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I was going to ask, was this running 24 hours?
We got hold of the, I mean, obviously with clearance from the powers that be, from the authorities, and it was readily given. The campus security, they were warned there'd be people in there all sorts of times, as long as there's no parties or booze or things like that. And the students weren't that way oriented. The value to them of doing this, I think they perceived it as being far more valuable than being irresponsible. I don't recall any incidents, none whatsoever.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Absolutely amazing. Later on, when was that? That would have been 71, mid-71, that computer was there. Took over in end of 69 when I left as having got my honours degree. So it was there from 70. I forget for how many years it was there, probably about 3 or 4 years. We then moved on to a multi-access computer, also from ICR, 1902A, I think it was. And that was capable of running an operating system called Maximop.
Maximop?
Maximop. Maximum Online Processing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't invent the name. It was written by a chap called Arthur Dransfield at Queen Mary College, London. And this allowed interactive access. The terminals that you could connect were teletypes, clankety bonk, typing out onto paper. Bit like a golf ball typewriter thing spinning around and the characters hitting. I don't know how they worked, but they worked very slow, 10 characters a second, rolls of paper coming out. But the nice thing was that you didn't have to be in the queue. Well, you had to be in a queue for the terminals, but that's a multi-server queue. It's not one queue for the door to the computer room, to the card reader, to the printer. And that was very popular indeed. We then found a way, because to get terminals, you know, VDU type of terminals, screens.
Yes.
The ones that ICL provided were horrendously expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And these things didn't need any intelligence. The teletype function worked well on Maximop. It was geared around that. The editor worked. It wasn't a screen editor, line-by-line editor. So you locate your line, you change a cat to dog or something like that, and it prints out the new line, and mm-hmm. as you got it right, it was ready to go in your program. So we found terminals. Newbury Laboratories in the UK somewhere made a dirt cheap, best description, glass teletype.
Okay.
Right. Characters came in, they lined at the bottom, just they go on click, tick, click, tick, click, click, click on a piece of paper, scrolled up, and the next line came in, scrolled up. 24 lines later, it was off the top. Unlike the teletype where you could scroll back on your paper. So you need a lot more mental agility to use them.
Yeah.
But they were quiet. You didn't get the clankety clankety clank. They didn't waste a lot of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And they were cheap.
When did the first Unix-based systems start?
We didn't put in Unix.
Oh, you never went Unix. Okay. No. Because those were quite popular sort of from the mid-70s, weren't they? The DEC machines. And.
But DEC wasn't Unix.
Was not?
No, it ran the DEC operating system.
Okay.
Which might be similar to Unix. I didn't ever know it.
Unix-like OS.
Unix-like, yeah. I don't know how you would describe the ICL operating systems.
On the mainframes?
Or the IBMs. Gave it a Fortran program and said, compile it, compiled.
Yeah.
And you were programming in Fortran.
Fortran was the programming language of the day.
That was the language, yeah.
Okay.
COBOL. To some degree, for the business science students.
Right.
There was an attempt to get a sort of payroll system running on that computer for the admin. It
couldn't handle it.
Didn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take off.
Yeah.
In the end, we got hold of QPAC.
I don't.
I remember them. Oh, man, you missing the legends.
It's before my time, Mike.
Des Gears. Yeah. And who was the other guy? I think I've got it right. They wrote a package for ICL's other line of computers. 1500 payroll, something like that.
Okay.
1500 series of computers. And then they adapted it for, I think, a range of machines and called it QPAC.
Okay.
Very easy for the administrators to use. Ran it quite happily on the mainframe.
Yeah.
I think it currently runs on PCs now, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days. The main function of that computer was still academic. There were some major research projects on the go. People in economics, academics in economics, let me be duly respectful, nice people. Psychology. There was a chap in water research, and they had large databases, and eventually persuaded them to store them on cards and access them interactively, and it took a bit of doing. Mm-hmm. You know, when you know that your stuff on cards and it works, you can touch,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to it's probably still on the computer, but we don't have dropped the tape. That conversion was always quite tricky to do. But there was quite a lot of serious research. The chemists I know did a lot of stuff. There was a graphical output. We had a plotter, I suppose.
Plotters, yes.
And plotted big graphs of molecular structures, watched them coming off, and wondered what on earth they were about. But it was, say, very much, very much scientific.
It was
that environment. That persisted.
Mm-hmm.
And when the admin stuff came along and QPAC started to run, it was a bit of a pain, actually.
Yeah.
There was a general ledger that ran also.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it helped the administration. Very pleased that it did. But it sort of got in the way.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, throughout this time, computers were starting to miniaturize and the PC revolution was on the horizon. Take us quickly through the sort of time frame between these machines and the introduction of the IBM PC and beyond that.
Well, that 1902A become a 1904S or something like that, the next range up. More terminals connected. We got to the point that we found that these terminals would run on two wires, two wire connections. You didn't need a big fat cable like these ones lying on the floor here. Two wires would do it. A little bit of flex, and you jumper the pins on the plug that plugs into the computer, and lo and behold, the signals went across the road to physics quite happily. We had a trench under the road. We could put wires through.
Probably in violation of the Telecoms Act or something at the time.
It might have been, but I think at that stage that road was actually handed over to the university. So I don't think it was a public road anymore.
Okay.
And so what?
Who cares?
So what? Easier to get forgiveness than to get permission. But the point is that by the time those signals got, I don't know, 100 meters or so down the wires, they were perfect at the other end. The shape of the signals, the pulses, perfectly adequate to work. Yep. And that grew further that eventually, I think the longest line was to my house.
Okay.
We rented lines from the post office, as it then was.
When was this?
Certainly well before 1988.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, I was...
So was it the PC had been invented?
The PCs were around. They were very expensive. Mm-hmm. They were very slow. Mm-hmm. Certainly the PCs were around because they weren't popular. They weren't widespread.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they were expensive devices. Mm-hmm. I bought mine, what did I pay, 3,300 Rand in, I suppose, about 1985, 86, yep. I suppose that's sort of the era. A lot of family money. Mm-hmm. Had an Apple II, that for the kids for Christmas. And there's long stories about that one. but to be able to be on your own machine that you're working on, 8 o'clock at night, and you're through to the computer center, and you can be doing whatever you're doing on the network. And so it's then teams 2 o'clock in the morning, and your wife's saying, where the hell are you?
Was this all on campus, or were you running around Grahamstown?
I was, in terms of Rhodes campus, in the sort of center of the campus. Now, I stayed up in a suburb called Somerset Heights.
Okay, so it wasn't even on campus.
The distance along the road was 1.6 miles.
Miles, sure.
Something like that, two kilometers must have been. The wire length was longer because the wires had to get down to the telephone exchange in Grahamstown, one set of wires, and they jumped it there to wires that went to my house.
So how many homes were connected this way?
Oh, about 20, 30.
Wow. And it was all on old copper cables provided
by modems.
The post office.
No modems. Worked at 9,600 bits per second. Those who stayed closer than me, they'd get up to 19.2 kilobits per second. I mean, that's living. From a clunk, 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 clunk speed of a teletype. Perfectly adequate to work. Perfectly adequate. You're talking about text screens. You're not talking about graphic screens.
What were you doing in those days with these machines at home at night?
Playing with email.
Email. Okay.
Email.
To each other in the community.
No, well, yes.
Before the internet.
Getting the system to work. Mm-hmm. When we got the system to work, one of the things that I distinctly remember, some found an email address of some guy in America, and he had stuff that, I forget quite how it worked. There were lots of Americans, lots of projects in America that wanted email into Africa. They were sponsoring people in Kenya. They were sponsoring projects in Mozambique. There was, you name it. There was a lot of that on the go. And now they had to work through this apartheid-written, subject to Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1988. I had visitors, must be 20, 30 visitors came and stayed at my place to see what we were doing from America. Oh, man.
And what did the
I was on drugs. You know that. I must have been. I've never taken them. I'm not going to take them. I don't need to take them. But life was, it was floating up there. It was floating up there. It worked and it worked and it worked. And you could hide all the failures. And there were lots.
So You must have had to convince the post office, which was the predecessor to Telkom or the postal service at the time, because there was no Telkom in the 1980s. In the 1990s. We'll get to Telkom a bit later in this discussion. But how easy was it to convince and ask the post office to do this stuff? Because you've been doing stuff here that the post office probably never heard of.
That made it easy.
Oh.
Okay. And when it came to a situation, you see, I played hockey,
okay,
one of my sports. And because I didn't like running very much, I was goalie,
okay,
for a team called Occasionals. And Occasionals describes it well, anything but professional players. And he was the centre forward in the old Gramium team, one of the chief techies of the post office.
Oh, convenient.
And if he wasn't going to cooperate, I was going to take him out next time he had the ball anywhere near my goals. Well, it wasn't quite like that. But Grahamstown is that sort of town.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a degree of split between academia and townsfolk.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't suffer from that. I wasn't academic at Rhodes. I was an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the town recognized this isn't a guy who lives way up there. Practically. No, they were nice people.
Okay.
And we found somewhere in a post office manual or in a post office pricing catalogue these things called local leads. Local leads inside a minimum radius area where you've only got one exchange is direct copper to copper.
Mm-hmm.
We persuaded the chief techie to take any filters off and the signals went straight through perfectly.
Okay.
Can't do it. When I did my master's in 77, 78 in Manchester, I then saw the specs for the circuits, for the chips that drive those wires, the RS-232 circuits, the ones that we were jumping the pins on and running two wires out of the socket. And the spec was 15 meters, 50 foot.
And you were running it for miles.
I didn't know, and the circuits didn't know. And I think that is one of my characteristics.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Just do it. It works if it's a try it. What are you going to lose?
Yeah.
What are you going to lose? Look, we were very cautious. We did not want to be caught blowing up
post office
telecom cables, post office cables.
Yeah.
Our connection points, we had 0.5 milliamp fuses. I mean, these are fuses that blow when you look at them.
Mm-hmm.
It was lightning, not just like in Joburg, but Grahamstown was lightning prone.
Yeah.
And we didn't need lightning up in, to strike in Somerset Heights and not strike down at the same voltage down on campus. You get a huge potential if you blow the cable.
Yeah.
We actually blew very few fuses.
Okay.
But we acted sensibly. I mean, this wasn't joke type of stuff. This was pretty serious.
You knew what you were doing.
But I was telling you about from home.
Mm-hmm.
10 o'clock at night, you find this guy in the USA, and you write to him. Yeah, can you help? Can you give us a comment about this? Yeah, I believe you got a package that'll do that. Can we, et cetera, et cetera? And he'd write back and say, "What? You're from Africa? How did it get out so quickly?"
This was on email.
And then you apply on email.
Was this?
I'm sitting at home.
This is prior to the IP protocol, though.
Yes. We were using dial-ups.
Dial-ups. Okay.
Stage, yeah.
Okay.
We had a schedule where the dial-ups would take place every hour.
What was the communication protocol back then?
The FidoNet protocol.
FidoNet. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It went through a series of phases. We had to do what the control data cyber could do, and make it look as though someone had typed it into a FidoNet PC, and to fool the PC and the PC with the dial and send the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And that these guys' typical response was, "How did it get here so quickly? And how did you reply so quickly?" didn't believe that the links could work like that so fast to the darkest continent. That it actually was working.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thrill you get out of having a response like that, you wowed one little yank somewhere.
So when did you and the guys at Rhodes start thinking about this idea that, hey, we can actually bring the internet here? What was the genesis of that? And what was the, did someone ask you to do it?
No, not at all. Not at all. They asked us not to do it.
You did it anyway.
The UniNet board, made up of experts from universities guiding the NOF on its, or how the network should work.
That's the National Research Foundation.
At the National Research, yeah. Said no to TCP/IP protocols. No.
Why?
Well, because there were ASA protocols floating around, or in theory, and that was the reason given. I'm a skeptic through and through. I'm sorry, that's me. Mm-hmm. I think they're just too lazy to actually get off the backsides and try to get something to work.
Mm-hmm.
In all fairness, Rhodes was very much an open university. Anti-apartheid like you cannot believe. We produced news as presidents like you can't believe.
There were
strings of them. Anti-government. We had folk locked up for, if it wasn't 90 days, it was extended 180 days for doing nothing, other than doing surveys in the homelands, that sort of thing.
One forgets it was a politically volatile environment at the time.
And you cannot forget that.
Yeah.
And you must not forget that.
Yeah.
It was very true. And particularly Afrikaans universities,
yes.
I mean them no offence whatsoever,
sure.
That the lager mentality had set in,
mm-hmm.
that you're on your own, you're isolated, and there is no way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
The fact that Rhodes was a liberal university and had more of a global view on things and was challenging the apartheid regime at the time, do you think that actually created the environment that allowed you to do this? Is it why it happened at Rhodes and not at, say, UP?
Oh, very definitely.
Yeah.
Very definitely. I had free rein to do what I wanted to do as ITW. There wasn't a job description.
Yeah.
I didn't walk into a post that someone else had set up and established the routines, whatever it is.
And you were in the rural Eastern Cape. No one was really watching what was happening down there. You were off the radar.
We were isolated anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, geographically. You want to go and buy a smart fridge, you'll... hour and a half to drive down to PE, because the locals wouldn't stock it because Grahamstonians would drive to PE to go and buy their fridges. Yeah,
right.
So the town wouldn't be stocked with that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But there's I've no doubt whatsoever that being at Rhodes when I went on to some conferences in the USA and some places in the USA, that doors were open to me because I was from Rhodes,
mm-hmm.
that would not have been open to other universities.
Oh, interesting.
I was told by my hostess at the University of California, Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to pitch up there from South Africa in 1988, 1989, 1990, that era, you'd have a riot on the campus. And she checked, is there a Washington University in Washington somewhere there, basically a black-oriented type university. And she checked with that university, wherever it was,
mm-hmm.
Someone from Rhodes,
sure.
what's the story?
Yeah.
Welcome him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And they did.
Amazing. Amazing. UC Berkeley's famous, though. I mean, they were, in terms of early networking and computing.
Yeah. I had to go there.
Yeah. So tell us the story then. How did this happen? Who was involved? How did it happen?
Okay. That early Maximop system. Excuse me, I just need to wipe my eyes.
Sure. Let's take a short break there. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's take a short break there. Do you want to take a bathroom break? Do you want some water?
No, not yet. I'll have a slick of water though.
Sure.
That was a fun time.
I'm just going to stretch my legs too, actually. Randy Bush, where was he? He was in Portland.
Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
You don't just say Portland, you say Portland, Oregon.
Because there's many Portlands, yeah.
Many Portlands in the USA.
I've actually been to Portland.
Okay.
All right, really?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, do you want another audio market today?
No. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
About USA, getting into USA, places like that. So, doors open. Why did we do it?
Yeah. The question was how. Let's do the internet story. The tale. Feel free to just start.
Okay. I can't tell you when there was an idea to say, we're going to connect to the internet at Rhodes University and stuff the world.
Okay.
Okay. Others don't want it. That there wasn't that moment. There was a moment when, oh, way back, when that 1902A, that was the teletypes, Maximop had a mail system. You could send a message, you could type in a message for someone else to pick up, you know, address it to them, only they would pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And big wow. I mean, you know, the comments that I sort of got was, why on earth, dude? I mean, I just go to the office next door and I chat to my friends. Why must I send them a mail message? Because I got to walk down the computer center to those terminals. And, you know, I mean, why? You know, not so bad if you're in the same building as the computer, but when you're three roads away, why? There was no point doing it whatsoever. Okay, so fair enough. That's a very, very valid point. And then I think one of the triggers, I think there were two key triggers, but one was when Dr. Ryan Arendt, president of the FRD, as it then was, said he understood enough about networking and was a visionary beyond belief. He has seed money, established UniNet, appoints a manager, Leitvik Shaw, and says, organize something. And they laid out a network, multi-protocol network, interconnecting certain of the university, the bigger university, not every last one, but it was possible to, but it, the initial one didn't have that. And you now had inter-university connections, but not inter-university computing or networking, because being a multi-protocol network, you get one set of IBM computers at the universities, WITS, POCH, Stellenbosch, no, not Stellenbosch, matters not. They could interconnect, but they couldn't interconnect to the VACs at Stellenbosch, to the UNIVAC at UCT, or to the boroughs at UPE, but they could all connect to the cyber at Rhodes University. Right. Magic, magic. The salesman involved in dealing with our site, the account executive, or whatever you want to call these guys, nice guy, George Campbell, produced a reel of tape and said, Mike, there's the IBM protocols. Do something with it. And so we did. And we found that we could connect the VACs in physics, run by Justin Jonas.
At Rhodes.
Yeah. Across the road, where the wires ran. Oh, really? The first two wires?
Yes.
Same room.
Mm-hmm.
Same connection.
Mm-hmm.
But he installed a package called JNet on this VACs, which would talk IBM protocols. We installed the NJEF package on the cyber from courtesy of George Campbell, and broops, they spoke IBM languages to others. So we could pull out the mail from the VAX mail system.
Yes.
And Justin, by whatever magic means, got it into the IBM communication protocols, could move it into the cyber's IBM communication protocols, where we could pull it out and put it into our own mailing system that we had written. Dead easy. So we now could interchange between two different makes of computers run by effectively two different organizations. I mean, Justin and I got on fairly well. We had our differences, no question about it. Jealousies about my computer's better than yours. You know? But the view was the same. Okay, interconnect. Now, we then could see that we could link up to any of those IBM computers. And we could then take the mail out of the IBM computers, out of, I think it was called PROFs, on the IBM machines, IBM mainframes, pull it out of that lot, get it down into a cyber, pump it into the VACs. So the VACs in physics could now send mail to any of the IBM machines. We had a close look how that worked. We could pull it out and put it into another protocol that would get to this UNIVAC at UCT and to the Hewlett-Packards at the University of Natal, Durban, and anyone who was interested and willing to do something at their end. If they're not going to do something on their end, it's not going to work. So that then opened the door to getting email to flow throughout South African universities that wished to participate, and not all did by any means. Not interested. Mm-hmm. Not interested. Why would the liberal pinkos from Rhodes University ever wish to communicate with the crumped Okies at Potch? And it just so happens that the IT director at Potch, Philip Vellman, was anything but a crumped Okie. His view of networking, inter-university networking, his knowledge was more than mine by a long shot. His drive was very, very good, but he didn't seem to have the freedom to do what I had. Okay, I had no control over me.
I did what I wanted.
I mean, obviously, responsibly and in line with things. But
sure.
So it worked out that he and I exchanged an awful lot of email, initially on a dial-up link before this UniNet thing went in. But the mail would flow between these universities, and that was magic. And UniNet board took note of this lot eventually. I mean, no, they were nice guys, but I don't know, they weren't drivers. They weren't guys who were going to make things happen. And there was then a search for an international connection.
Why, do you remember? Why?
I don't know.
Okay. Because it had to be done, I suppose.
No, it wasn't because of that.
No.
It wasn't because of that.
There was an application for it.
I think it was a lovely saying in Afrikaans, met lang tanda. I think the isolationist of the 85, 86, 87, never mind the actual formal isolation in 88 with the comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. It had set in into this country. Yeah, our rugby teams couldn't go and play anywhere, never mind not just New Zealand.
Yeah.
The cricketers couldn't do anything because they would tear up the pitch. And so it went, and so it went. I mean, isolationist was
the era
so strong.
Of total onslaught. Remember that?
You've got it.
Yeah.
You've got it.
Yeah.
It got into people's minds so very, very, very strongly. Mm. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Why it didn't get into Rhodes, I don't know.
Different culture?
Maybe because we're isolated, we could do things no one actually saw us doing it. I don't know. I do not know. I cannot tell you.
Sure.
I know Vic Shaw was driving for it. He saw that we had to do it. And I think he was persuaded, encouraged from Ryan Arendt up at the top that this is where it's got to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, that's exactly right. And so I got hold of an outfit called BitNet, which was a very well-established network in the USA.
Okay.
Internet hadn't got widespread. The internet in the USA at that stage, very much a research network.
Okay.
We had a DARPANET, that's virtually another name for the thing, 64 kilobit per second trunks. I mean, really.
That was fast in those days.
I've got 25 megs at home. Okay. So it wasn't an open to anybody type thing, but BitNet was, even though it was basically university driven. And they said, you're welcome to connect. Yeah, be our guest.
Mm-hmm.
All you've got to have is a leased line. And the UniNet board turned that down.
Oh, no.
Just like that. They said, no, you'll connect to it. And the line will go in. And BitNet and ERN, European Academic Research Network, using the same protocol, same whatever it is, have seats on the BitNet board. And I don't know, Denmark or the Man in the Moon country would put a block on South Africa. So we didn't even try.
Mm.
And I phoned the lady who gave me permission and said, are you sure you mean this? Yeah, this is South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she said, no, you'll connect. Not a problem.
Okay.
Board wouldn't do it.
Mm.
And I was spitting tacks. Oh, you have no idea.
Mm.
Yeah, when I get cross, I can get very cross. Don't get close. Okay. So if that's the best UniNet board can do, I can do better. And in 88, set about trying to get our own international connection, just to get the email from Rhodes University internationally.
Mm-hmm.
Why we want to do it, I cannot tell you.
And it wasn't because because you wanted to do it. It was, there was something behind
it. I don't know. It seemed to be a good thing to do. It seemed to be a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If my friends at Rhodes University are going to tell me, why are you wasting university resources on messing around with this lot? Why are you this, that, the other? If I want to send a message to XYZ, I walk across to his office. Why? And no one could see it, really. Obviously, you've got to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they must be blind. I don't know.
Okay. So what happened next?
How'd you do that? Well, we had... Oh, bold as brass, I wrote to the folk at who run the DARPANET thing, as it was at the time, and said, okay, we want to connect, please, can we? What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And the guy eventually wrote back. I thought he'd jam South Africa, tear it up. Sol Lederman was his name. I don't know where that letter is. I might still be at Rhodes for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
And said, basically, you can't connect to our network. But you might try, boom, 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 and gave us four networks. Bottom of the list was FidoNet.
Okay.
And we tried boom, boom, and boom, and got nowhere. I mean, the failures. And then we tried other things also. And when we tried FidoNet, we could get the gateway from our cyber computer into the FIDO machine. We'd get the FIDO machine to dial wherever we wanted it to dial, and the mail would flow. But the only way to get it to the internet in terms of the FidoNet structures was through an outfit in Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And that was grossly unreliable.
Okay.
Now, I was very fortunate that lucky Laurie, you can't believe it. It was a visiting professor from University of Delaware. And through a contact and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, he gave me a sign-on on their computer, which was part of the then internet. Now, Telkom post office, bless its cotton socks, had rolled out an X25 network in South Africa, and the protocols that do international connections were called X75. We had one of those devices in the community center, in the computer room, because we were doing inter-South Africa university connections of all sorts of funny types. And that would go through the X75 and come out at the University of Delaware if you typed the right things in. So I could actually play on the internet at a horrendous cost.
Mm-hmm.
The country was served by one 9,600 bits per second SARPANET line.
2 kilobits a second.
And it cost, so it wasn't cheap. But bit on the bullet and blew the budget sort of thing. I could test if we mailed to my email address at University of Delaware, whether it arrived or not. And from there, I could mail back and see if it pitched up in the cyber. So I had a test channel, and I mean, that was gold, absolute gold. It was expensive gold, but it was gold. And the Netherlands link didn't work.
Mm.
And then this guy, Pat Terry, I've mentioned him sleeping under the console in the computer room to do his ray tracing stuff. A friend of long standing, a huge critic of what I was doing. Why are you wasting the university's money? What's this all about? Why bother? Went off to an international standards organization conference. He was there as a individual, because you couldn't be there as a South African, because ISO, etc. Long stories, okay? 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized he was way out of date with the discussions that had been taking place by email with the committee members. Yeah, and he came back. You think there was a road to Damascus? And you can... Lazarus. That was him. That was Pat. And he'd linked... One of the guys on the committee was a chap called Randy Bush, quite well into the FidoNet system. And
who was Randy Bush? What did he do?
He was a software writer.
Okay.
For some outfit in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Just a geek.
Very much a geek. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a geek through and through.
Yeah, yeah.
He was brought up, he admits, to hating things like the Salazar regime in Spain, Portugal, wherever it was, you know, the repressive regime there. Part of his family life,
okay.
To hate apartheid. I heard a story that he actually spent time in jail for protesting, an anti-apartheid protest.
Oh, wow.
And Pat now meets this guy. And, of course, they hit it off just like that. So, I mean, they're both computer geeks.
Yeah.
And Pat offers to forward, Randy offers to forward mail from Pat. And Pat realizes he's not geared up to handle that sort of thing. So he comes back with the latest of the FidoNet software and a promise from Randy that he will forward Pat's mail. And it took a few emails and he will forward Rhodes University email. He cleared it with his lawyers that Rhodes University is an okay organization. I mean, there's another door open because it was Rhodes.
Yes.
Other universities, I don't think, would have done it, could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Randy says, right, we'll forward your email. So late, about September, I think it must have been, 88, Mike and Randy are exchanging email quite happily. Mm-hmm. And it's working.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get to Delaware and I can get back again. Oh, man, this is living. That is the breakthrough, not the internet.
Okay.
That worked.
88.
88. Hmm. Late 88.
Apps were you using to send email in those days?
What
apps were you using?
What apps? What's an app?
On your computer, on your PC, I presume you're using
a PC.
No? Yeah. On the main?
Into the cyber.
On the cyber.
Log into the cyber. Type the command mail.
Okay.
Type in your mail.
I understood.
Edit it if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Attach a file if you want to. You could do that. That was pretty good.
Okay.
Not attach, you copied.
Mm-hmm.
You just said copy this file. With the editor. I mean, edit and copy files in.
So PC mail apps only came later.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that had some way to go still.
Yeah.
We were forwarding through a PC, 4.77 megahertz PC with a 10 megabyte disk. Didn't have 4 megabytes of RAM, I don't think so, because I think the DOS had a problem with that. Microsoft...
640 usually.
Whatever it was. No, it was a megabyte. Over a megabyte, you had to...
1 meg.
Over 640K, you had to do something.
Yeah.
So,
HiMem.sys, if I remember.
You got it, yeah. And FidoNet software in there, running very happily. But we had to write the gateway and then invent a protocol of some kind or other to move the stuff from the cyber into the FidoNet PC, make the FidoNet PC think some Okie's just typed it in and broops it across through dial-up to Randy.
Mm-hmm.
And he would somehow or other get it into the internet. I think there were about 2 or 3 links he went through. But FidoNet had gateways into the internet. All of the mail networks of the world were interconnected by that stage. You could mail to anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Long-winded, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
We opened it for campus use in February... 89.
Okay.
And went to the other universities.
What was the next university to latch onto this?
I don't know. I do not know.
Okay.
I'm sure I could look it up somewhere in my mail archives.
Yeah. But there must have been...
I don't know.
You were communicating with guys at other universities, so there must have been universities that were... much more progressive in terms of the stuff.
Yeah, UCT beyond question.
Okay.
High up on the list.
Yeah.
Alan Barrett at the University of Electrical Engineering Department at the University of Natal. University of Natal, Durban, I think you've got to call it.
Yes.
As it then was.
Yes.
But not the campus, not the IT director, that individual.
Mm-hmm.
The IT director at UCT, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Witz, no. That took a long time. What we did, UniNet took the approach now to try to open the door. Yeah. What would it take to get Randy to agree to forward email for other universities? CSR, no. Boom.
Yeah.
Forget it. Making H-bombs, forget it. which was the belief, right or wrong, matters not. Perception is the truth. So, what other ones? The FRD, yes, very much so. Vic Shaw got on quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Not generic, not widespread throughout any campus,
mm-hmm.
but Rhodes. We did a splash on the Rhodes staff newsletter at the beginning of 89 and made it widely known to everybody on campus that international email was there.
Mm-hmm.
It worked, sort of. It was free.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of academics added their words to it that, you know, the ease of communicating, this, that, and the other. And I think that stimulated quite a bit. One of the keenest users on the campus was Professor Peter de Villiers from Divinity. And if Peter de Villiers said something went wrong, there was something wrong. I don't know how. He had obviously come with experience of using networks like BitNet.
Okay, okay.
And he was an avid user of this network. And,
okay.
Yeah, you always have markers on anything. Watch that one, because if he squeals, there is reason for squeal. If he squeals, ignore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was one. If he squeals, take care, because yeah, follow it up and value yeah. what he said to you. And he was one of them in Divinity. I couldn't believe it. One of the keenest users. I know by March, the Black Sash were sending stuff out on that link. I think there was a Sharpeville shooting down in Newtonhague. They didn't know how to use the email. They weren't on campus. They weren't allowed to use the email.
Mm-hmm.
Does that matter? Didn't matter to me. And they wanted a hand, and I saw some of the stuff they were putting together. Now, if the Nats had bothered to tap into unencrypted wires, I really wonder where I would have ended up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would not have been
John Forster Square,
being,
probably.
pushed over with a bar of soap under my foot. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, it's all speculative.
But it would not have been pleasant.
But take us through the...
So, at that point in time, it then opened up
mm-hmm.
for Rhodes, and Vic and Randy exchanged ideas on how to expand this and what was required. Effectively, the university had to sign a declaration they weren't making H-bombs and they weren't supporting apartheid, and they were, I don't know what it was that mm-hmm. they had to sign,
mm-hmm.
A declaration that they were, this was academic material.
Yes.
And Randy, I think quite cautiously, but with a good spirit, right, you know, Rhodes can now take the stuff from Potch and pump it across the fighter net and vice versa on the way back, and then the next university and the next university. Some didn't bother.
And I presume you had to upgrade these systems quickly.
Oh, my word, yes. We couldn't get modems to go faster than 14.4.
Right.
Now, everything up to that point where Rhodes got its email on was scrounged equipment.
Mm-hmm.
It was never a university project.
Mm-hmm.
It was never and would never have been in my job description to say, yeah, email is part of what's got to happen.
Yes.
It would have been the other way around. The computers were scrounged, donated. The modems were used to dial to Potch. Someone advertised modems on sale. There was a newspaper, a Computer Weekly.
Mm-hmm. Computer Week, I think.
Yeah, but, mm-hmm. Computer Week.
Mm-hmm.
In there was a little advert that some guy had 9600 synchronous dial-up synchronous modems. Wanting to suppose we'd gone over to Diginet now. Mm-hmm. Remember Diginet? 64 yes. kilobits per second, if you were lucky.
Yes. Cost a fortune.
And yeah, oh, yes, yeah. very much so.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote to this guy and said, you know, best I can give you is a donation certificate. You can claim it back from the tax man. But I'd like those modems.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, I got them.
Huh?
Scrounged there. Some company went belly up in Port Elizabeth, and they donated one of their machines to us, one of their stock items, gave the other one to University of Port Elizabeth. I don't know what they did with it, but I know what we did with ours. And it was scrounging, and it was also basically free time. It wasn't...
Just a passion.
We had our jobs to have work to do.
Yeah.
Jacko and Dave Wilson, the guys who did all the technical work on this lot,
They were in your team at Threads.
Yeah, you were closely together. Assistant programmers. Mm-hmm. There's a trick to getting South Africa's best to go and live in a place like Grahamstown. I'll tell you the trick, if you can bear with me.
Of course.
First of all, Jacko had family in the area. So that was a starting point. Okay. So he had reason to come to Rhodes, down to Grahamstown. And with his computer ability and talent and all the rest of it, I mean, there was no other jobs other than working at the Mike Lobby in the computing center, which must have horrified him, I think. Maybe not. So what you do is that you go for the wife and the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Grahamstown being a nice little town, nice quiet town, you make sure when the wife arrives that the Rhodes University Women's Association says, welcome. You know, you need curtains for the house that you're moving into? Yeah, yeah, we've got the stock of leftover curtains from someone else, so you know, I've got curtains. There's a good school over there, not very far away. Yeah, you get the wife settled like that, and the husband can't move. Oh, we did it to Dave also. And Dave actually tried to move out and he, at one stage.
Yeah.
And he then cancelled his resignation. It upset the folk in human resources terribly, and I said, there's no way this guy goes if he wants to stay.
Yeah.
We keep him.
Yeah.
We must have been the best because we got it to work.
Yeah.
We must have been South Africa's best. I'm sorry. Not boasting or bragging, but if the others didn't do it, why not?
Yeah.
So there was difficulty selling it to users.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I just need a break.
Oh, yes, sure. I'm actually just going to grab a quick water myself, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'll be back in a sec. I think let's move on to the internet stuff.
Okay.
And the TCP/IP stuff.
That's the boring stuff.
Sorry?
That's the boring stuff. I'll answer your questions.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. What is the time today?
It is about 5 to 4.
Oh, wow. Okay. We should probably start moving towards the conclusions. So I think let's...
go for it.
Let's accelerate a little bit towards the project. And
what do you want done?
Sure. You don't need an audio mark. No. Okay. So, Mike, let's fast forward a little bit and to the period just before 1991, where the first internet or was it the first international TCP/IP connection that was established over a leased line. What led up to that in the preceding months?
Well, the volume of mail, no question about it. By then, I think every university was connected.
Mm-hmm.
Technicons were a separate issue. They didn't seem to be part of the group. They were. No matter.
Mm-hmm.
15 universities, lots of mail. The telephone bill at that stage was now paid for by the UniNet project, not by Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
I've still got a log of the calls in the account. There's like 30,000 a month, and a leased line to USA would cost a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't sustain. Plus, using dial-up, strong forward type of system, and the volume's going warm and hockey stick curve type of stuff, it wasn't sustainable. And, I mean, the solution clearly was to get an internet connection. So that was the motivation. So all we needed was to get a leased line through to Randy. Randy was very willing. 91, we couldn't get Cisco routers in the country. The bans were still in place, and Cisco from California certainly wasn't going to deal with South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to use PC-based routing software. I think we used a thing called KA9Q, but whatever that might mean. Mm-hmm. And that was a target. We would use that at this end. Randy would use that at his end, so the two things would be compatible. And with a leased line, we would then be able to route the mail directly from the cyber, or maybe some intermediate machine, I don't know. I think at that stage, probably would have been an intermediate machine, a Unix machine.
Okay.
I think the version of Unix was FreeBSD.
Okay.
And if we could pump it out the cyber quickly enough so that it didn't back up into this FreeBSD, this Unix machine. It might have been a Xenix machine. Matters not.
Mm-hmm.
A Unix-based system, which is very, uses internet as a natural protocol, basically.
Yeah.
You know, stuff's all geared around that. It would then fly straight across to Randy, and the stuff would come back. Yeah, it wouldn't queue up, back up on his machine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. Okay. I mean, what's the motivation? Handle the volume.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as a browser. What's a browser? Very much were things like FTP, which you probably don't know about.
Yes, I remember.
File transfer protocol. Have you used FTP?
Yeah.
Raw FTP.
Yeah.
FTP to a host.
I remember.
You have actually done that.
I remember when I first started in journalism.
Oh, yes. You've been around a bit.
We connected to websites like sunet.c, ftp.sunet.c, which was a big FTP server in Sweden. And I think there was one in Norway as well at the time.
So you could do that.
And there were protocols. I don't know if protocol is the right word. For Archie, Veronica, I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yes, Gopher. Yes, that's right.
I don't even remember what we were using
but
those for.
Gopher came later.
It was later.
Much later.
Okay.
Much later. Yeah.
Okay.
And there were things called WAIS, Wide Area Information Systems. These were all precursors to the HTTP protocol.
Yeah. There was no one was really using the web at that stage. Maybe
there wasn't a web.
It was kind of being invented by Tim Berners-Lee around that time.
Yeah.
And the Netscape, not Netscape, it was called NCSA Mosaic, I think.
Yeah.
It was the first browser, one of the first browsers.
Mm. Yeah.
But there wasn't much online.
That wasn't around when we did our connection.
Yeah.
But the only catch was with this nice new 9600 bit per second link to Andy was that it congested immediately.
Okay.
I don't think it took an hour or two.
Good grief.
It didn't take 2 days. So the only time you could really do any FTPing was if you had a connection at home at 2 a.m.
Okay.
Which I did.
So was it clogged with FTP or was it clogged with email?
Email.
Email.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a thing called domain storms. Now, at that point in time, before we could connect the internet, we had to have the ZA domain isolated.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't use the name servers of the internet because, first of all, you couldn't connect to the internet.
Yeah.
So you had to fix up your own root servers in South Africa and all the redundancy that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what you then had to do is say, right, as soon as that plug goes in, oops, everybody's got to change at the same instant. And most of them said, name servers? Domain names? We don't know about that. Don't know what to do.
So back in the days of the cyber when you were doing email in those early days, was the email format much as we understand it today, or was it something very different?
Well, initially it was homegrown.
Okay.
And when I had that link through to the University of Delaware, I could download these things called RFCs, Request for Comments, which are the open, public, for anybody, just as long as you've got bandwidth to download them. The specifications for email. And RFC 822 defined how email headers should be and the body should look. And there was even a RFC for the standard on how to munge email. You take it out of one protocol system into another protocol system. When you put into the IBM profs, they don't know about RFC 822 headers. They've got IBM proprietary headers. When you send it to Hewlett-Packard, Hewlett-Packard put in what they felt like or that type of thing.
Yes.
So there was a standard laid down that said that if you're going to get it into the internet, you will munge your mail to look like that.
Yes, okay.
Okay. So I managed to download those RFCs, and we then obviously moved over onto those as quickly as we could.
Yeah.
Which took a bit of doing.
Yeah, yeah. So how long were you at Rhodes for? When did you eventually leave there?
Beginning of 94.
Beginning 94, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was there as a student, end of 65. So my student years were 66 to 69. Mm-hmm. And then wilderness years for 18 months.
Sure. So take it, what did the system look like at Rhodes when you left in 94? What was there?
You've seen a picture of it, broken down 1301. And you've actually seen a picture of the 1901. I think it was one I sent to you.
Yes. We'll include some of those pictures in this article.
That it looked like that. And that was in an air-conditioned room.
And how widespread was email use at the university by 94?
By 94? Mm. Oh, no, that, you name it.
Everyone was doing
you
it.
You name it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you left to join Uninet, did you? As CEO?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I went to, the title was Manager of Uninet, mm-hmm. at what was then still the foundation for the FRD.
Yes.
Later to become the NRF. To run and manage the network,
mm-hmm.
Which was quite exciting.
And how long did you do that for?
Till I retired, 2000, and then carried on contract till about 2002.
Okay. And retired since then. And what's life like now? Are you still...
Fantastic.
Are you still... you say you've got a 25 meg, I presume that's a fiber line at home.
No.
How are you connected at that sort of speed?
Well, the complex has got one pipe coming in.
Okay.
Fiber pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into a D-SLAM.
Okay.
Our D-SLAMs, yes. not Telkom D-SLAMs. And each unit has an ADSL router. And I wind them up to maximum speed, which is 25 megs.
Yes.
And you 2 megs upload and 25 megs download.
Okay.
Well, I think we've actually limited it down to about 20.
Yes.
You can stream 4 videos into the same household quite happily.
Right.
Four megs does quite a good stream of a video.
Yeah. So you've stayed very much
stayed alive.
Interested in technology, and you were telling me on the way over here a little bit earlier that you've been playing around with ChatGPT as well. Tell us about that story.
Oh well. This funny thing pitched up on my XP, on my Windows 11 system. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a jipped Windows 11 because the hardware can't run Windows 11, but it can.
Okay. because of the security restrictions. Yeah.
Okay. It's no fun to do anything straight down the line.
I'm seeing a pattern here, Mike.
No fun. You've got it. You've seen it. So, amongst other things, it offered to write me a limerick.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young man from Swanee,
mm-hmm.
who, I don't know, did something in a plane.
It sounds like it's going to be rude.
No. And never did it again.
Okay.
I mean, and I wrote back and said, but that doesn't rhyme.
Right.
And, you pronounce Swanee. Yeah, I mean, you spell it out in sort of a bit like Swanee River type of thing. And it chirps back at me that he quotes this dictionary, which may or may not exist for all I know. But that's what they say, you pronounce it like that, Swain, which rhymes with a plane and the game. And he seemed to be quite taken with and quite receptive. And I told him every South African is going to be laughing at him. And he wrote another limerick, and it worked properly.
This time, fixed it.
I don't know what we'll do now if you try it on your one.
All right. Well, you've probably taught ChatGPT how to say Twine correctly.
I hope so.
I'll go and check it out now.
Go and check it out. Okay, let me know.
Excellent.
I don't do much in that lot. Sorting out old ladies' PCs.
Okay.
I've had quite a project in souping up old computers for the black staff.
Mm-hmm.
It is surprising how much they know about computers when they're not brought up on the technology I was brought up on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Yeah, I don't come racist. That's not in my. I hope it's not in my nature. I don't project it. I hope I don't project it. But, yeah, to then see these guys take to these machines, and they got it for their kids. You know, the kids require it at school, and mm-hmm. haven't got machines at home. And the one guy comes along to, I had to soup up or put something into his machine, and he comes along with his cell phone and does a transfer on the cell phone. And this is the guy who does the maintenance. You know, he cleans the lavatories when they're stuck, and he.
Yeah.
I'm staggered.
It's amazing how technology has just infiltrated our lives and everyone's lives.
It's much more than that. In the email days, mm-hmm. I traveled into Africa. I was invited to one or two conferences, one in Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya. And I spent quite a bit with the folk in Mozambique. Now, I've never met a guy as bright as Americo Mashangwe mm-hmm. from Mozambique. Yeah, that guy was bright.
Mm-hmm. Who was he?
IT guy.
Okay.
Americo. Mashangwe, I think. Forget how you pronounce it. He and my daughter got on very well. He stayed in our house. They played one of these games with the beans. Yeah? You must have seen these Awari games. Mm-hmm. You've got a board
in
and you rub
very
the beans.
Very popular in many African countries.
Oh, man, fantastic game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they hit it off very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I looked, and this was before apartheid had broken in this country.
Yes.
And I looked at these guys, the Nigerians, for all their drugs and whatever else, they were just damn nice people. The Ghanaians, even better. The Kenyans, yes, like they wanted to absorb knowledge. And I thought, how much damage has been done to South Africa mm-hmm. by us having locked the door to people? There's got to be those sort of people in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to meet some of them. Now a gardener mm-hmm. got kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they've taken to this laptop. And I souped up a Jippo had Windows 11 onto it. You know, that's kept me quite busy, and it's extremely satisfying.
Before I let you go, Mike, though, do you keep in contact with any of the guys that you worked with back at Rhodes? I mean, is Randy Bush still around? Do you talk to him at all?
No. Very seldom. I mean,
drifted apart.
Yeah. Mm. We did our thing. We did what we did.
Yeah.
We did other things afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Randy, I've met him since then.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 20-year celebration at Rhodes.
Ah.
He came out with his second wife. I think, but then he was based in Japan.
Okay.
When I got to Randy's house, that's early 90s.
This is in Portland, Oregon.
In Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon. And his then-wife, Joan. Now, Joan had to be woken up at times in the small hours of the morning because the phone line had hung or the computers had hung. To say, please, Joan, won't you reboot the blah, 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 blah. And she wouldn't know anything about a computer. So I get greeted by her. The chap down the road put a bullet into his son's computer. She hated computers. Married to a guy like Randy. I don't know how that could have stayed. She passed away, unfortunately.
Shame.
But
that 20, yeah, that anniversary must have been pretty amazing.
That was quite nice, mm. Yeah. Mm. I don't know if you want to let this out on the air, but the Vice Chancellor of Rhodes University stood us up. He was due to open the session. He was out having dinner with someone else. Peter Clayton had to stand in.
You sound quite bitter about that.
Well, it tells you something, I suppose. Don't know what it tells you.
So, Mike, let's not...
That's probably not, please.
No, we'll cut that
probably
out.
Probably a good idea.
Can we cut that out? Yeah.
Probably not a good idea.
Yeah, let's cut that out. Let me just do the conclusions then.
Mm. Well, I don't know what else to add. I mean, when the link went in, the worst things that we had was this domain stuff. Thing called a domain storm. I don't know how much you know about how domain systems work.
Nothing.
But you send out a query to say, I want to get to blogs.co.za or blogs.sweden or whatever it might be. And your machine goes to another machine, which goes to another machine, which gets referred to yet another machine, each one knowing more about the domain you're talking about. because you've got to come back with a number called the IP address.
Mm-hmm.
And without that IP address, you don't connect. And as you're going up this chain, it will refer you to, say, a list of five machines. So you roll a dice with five sides on it, or your computer does that,
mm-hmm.
and picks one of them and goes to that one. But if you've got a circular loop there, right, that this one says go back to the first one, which goes to the second, to the third, to the fourth, to the one that's got the loop in it, back to the first, the second, you're going to get nothing but requests for what is the address of blogs.sweden.
Mm-hmm. So what's the junk and traffic?
That then says, well, not so bad if it's Sweden, but if it's ZA, it's referred to somewhere in South Africa. So it comes down the line
mm-hmm.
and gets in the way of email. And it gets told to come back and go to another one in South Africa, another one, another one. And it, like a nuclear fission,
mm-hmm.
boom, hits one, and it fans out to hit two, which hands out to hit four, which hands out to hit eight. And next to no time, all you've got coming down the line is request for the IP address of the same machine, the same machine, the same machine, and nothing else can flow on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened several times.
Okay.
Very difficult to get hold of, to pin them down, because you've got to identify where the loop is.
And yes.
You're not on those campuses to identify them. You don't have access to their computers.
Yes.
And it's not very nice.
You've
got to do ugly things like disconnect this university, boom.
Mm.
Phone up the IT guy if you can, if it's daytime,
mm-hmm.
and say, sorry, guy, we think it's your machine. Yeah. We're not sure. So you're off the internet.
Yeah.
You don't become very popular, particularly if it wasn't their machine. So there were events like that.
Mike, it's been wonderful chatting to you and catching up on some of this amazing part of South African history. And as you mentioned, Julianne de Toy did an amazing piece on, was it Karoo Spaces, I think her website is called.
Yeah, that's her outfit is what she calls.
A year or two back, which we republished on Tech Central. Well worth a read. It goes into huge amount of detail. I think it's a 30 or 40,000 word article. About all the characters, and there are great photographs there of some of the people involved. So I highly recommend that people go and have a read of that if they don't know the backstory and the history of how the internet originally came to South Africa. Mike, so I know there's a lot more to talk about. We could probably talk for days about some of the history, but great to have some insight. And thank you so much for sharing those insights with Tech Central and being a guest on our show, TCS Legends. It's much appreciated.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to speak about those days.
Fantastic.
Big part of my life.
Thank you so much, Mike. Thank you. That was great.
Okay. Done.
I think that's going to go down